and late too, and again, I thought, legends, legends everywhere I look. I started running into Madonna all over the world. I would do shows in Germany and Italy, and we would end up performing at the same European award shows. We'd greet each other as friends. At one awards show, I knocked on Mariah Carey's dressing room door. She opened it and outpoured the most beautiful otherworldly light. You know how we all have ring lights now? Well, more than 20 years ago, only Mariah Carey knew about ring lights. And no, I can't just say her first name. To me, she is always going to be Mariah Carey. I asked if we could take a photo together and tried to take one where we were standing. And she said, no, come stand here, darling. This is my light. This is my side. I want you to stand here so I can get my good side, girl. She kept saying that in her deep, beautiful voice. My good side, girl. My good side, girl. I did everything Mariah Carey told me to do, and we took the photo. Of course, she was completely right about everything. The photo looked incredible. I know I won an award that night, but I couldn't even tell you what it was. The perfect photo with Mariah Carey. That was the real prize. Meanwhile, I was breaking records, becoming one of the best-selling female artists of all time. People kept calling me the Princess of Pop. At the 2000 VMAs, I sang the Rolling Stones' I Can't Get No Satisfaction, and then, oops, I did it again, while going from a suit and hat to a glittery bikini top and tight pants, my long hair down. Wade Robson choreographed it. He always knew how to make me look strong and feminine at the same time. During the dance breaks in the cage, I did poses that made me look girly in the middle of an aggressive performance. Later, MTV sat me down in front of a monitor and made me watch strangers in Times Square give their opinions of my performance. Some of them said I did a good job, but an awful lot of them seemed to be focused on my having worn a skimpy outfit. They said I was dressing too sexy and thereby setting a bad example for kids. The cameras were trained on me, waiting to see how I would react to this criticism, if I would take it well or if I would cry. Did I do something wrong, I wondered. I'd just danced my heart out on an awards show. I never said I was a role model. All I wanted to do was sing and dance. The MTV show host kept pushing. What did I think of the commenters telling me I was corrupting America's youth? Finally, I said, some of them were very sweet, but I'm not the children's parents. I just gotta be me. I know there are gonna be people out there. I know not everyone's gonna like me. It shook me up. And it was my first real taste of a backlash that would last years. It felt like every time I turned on an entertainment show, yet another person was taking shots at me, saying I wasn't authentic. I was never quite sure what all the critics thought I was supposed to be doing. A Bob Dylan impression? I was a teenage girl from the South. I signed my name with a heart. I liked looking cute. Why did everyone treat me, even when I was a teenager, like I was dangerous? Meanwhile, I started to notice more and more older men in the audience, and sometimes it would freak me out to see them leering at me like I was some kind of Lolita fantasy for them, especially when no one could seem to think of me as both sexy and capable, or talented and hot. If I was sexy, they seemed to think I must be stupid. If I was hot, I couldn't possibly be talented. I wish back then I'd known the Dolly Parton joke. I'm not offended by all the dumb blonde jokes because I know I'm not dumb, and I also know that I'm not blonde. My real hair color is black. Trying to find ways to protect my heart from criticism and to keep the focus on what was important, I started reading religious books like the Conversations with God series by Neil Donald Walsh. I also started taking Prozac. When Oops, I Did It Again came out, I was a household name and in control of my career. Around the time of my first world tour for Oops, I was able to build my mom a house and settle my father's debts. I wanted to give them a clean slate. Chapter 11. There was hardly any time to rehearse. I only had a week to get ready. I was performing at the 2001 Super Bowl halftime show alongside Aerosmith, Mary J. Blige, Nelly, and NSYNC. Justin and the rest of his band had special gloves that shot fountains of sparks. I sang Walk This Way, wearing a sexy version of a football uniform with shiny silver pants, a crop shirt, and an athletic sock on one of my arms. I was brought to Steven Tyler's trailer to meet him right before the show, and his energy was incredible. He was such an idol to me. When we finished, the stadium lit up with fireworks. The halftime show was just one of the seemingly endless good things happening for me. I landed the Most Powerful Woman spot on the Forbes list of most powerful celebrities. The following year, I'd be number one overall. I learned that tabloids were making so much money off photos of me, I was almost single-handedly keeping some magazines in business. And I was starting to get amazing offers. At the 2001 MTV Video Music Awards that September, the plan was for me to sing I'm a Slave for You, and we decided I would use a snake as a prop. It's become an iconic moment in VMA's history, but it was even more terrifying than it appeared. The first time I saw the snake was when they brought it to a little back room of the Metropolitan Opera House in Manhattan where we would be doing the show. The girl who handed it over was even smaller than me. She looked so young, and she was very tiny with blonde hair. I couldn't believe they didn't have some big guy in charge. I remember thinking, you're letting us two little munchkins handle this huge snake? But there we were, and there was no going back. She lifted up the snake and put it over my head and around me. To be honest, I was a little scared. That snake was a huge animal, yellow and white, crinkly, gross-looking. It was okay, because the girl who gave it to me was right there, plus a snake handler and a bunch of other people. Everything changed, though, when I actually had to do the song on stage with the snake. On stage, I'm in performance mode. I'm in a costume, and there's nobody else there but me. Once again, the little munchkin came to me and handed me that huge snake, and all I knew was to look down, because I felt if I looked up and caught its eye, it would kill me. In my head, I was saying, just perform, just use your legs and perform. But what nobody knows is that as I was singing, the snake brought its head right around to my face, right up to me, and started hissing at me. You didn't see that shot on the TV, but in real life, I was thinking, are you fucking serious right now? This fucking goddamn snake's tongue is flicking out at me right now. Finally, I got to the part where I handed it back. Thank God. The next night, at Madison Square Garden in New York City, just days before September 11th, I performed a duet of The Way You Make Me Feel with Michael Jackson to celebrate the 30th anniversary of his solo career. In my heels, I prowled all over that stage. The audience went crazy. At one point, it felt like the whole crowd of 20,000 was singing along with us. Pepsi hired me to do commercials for them. In The Joy of Pepsi, I started out as a delivery driver, then wound up in a huge dance number. In Now and Then, I got to wear cute outfits from different eras. For the 80s section, I got made up as Robert Palmer for a version of Simply Irresistible. I was in hair and makeup for 4 hours, and they still didn't quite manage to make me convincing as a man. But in the 50s part, I loved dancing at the drive-in. I had Betty Boop hair. Working in all those different genres, I was amazed at how intelligently done those commercials were. The first movie I did was Crossroads, written by Shonda Rhimes and directed by Tamara Davis. We had filmed it in March 2001, around the same time I was recording the album Brittany. In the film, I was playing a good girl named Lucy Wagner. The experience wasn't easy for me. My problem wasn't with anyone involved in the production, but with what acting did to my mind. I think I started method acting, only I didn't know how to break out of my character. I really became this other person. Some people do method acting, but they're usually aware of the fact they're doing it. But I didn't have any separation at all. This is embarrassing to say, but it's like a cloud or something came over me, and I just became this girl named Lucy. When the camera was on, I was her. And then I couldn't tell the difference between when the camera was on and when it wasn't. I know that seems stupid, but it's the truth. I took it that seriously. I took it seriously to the point where Justin said, "Why are you walking like that? Who are you?" All I can say is it's a good thing Lucy was a sweet girl writing poems about how she was not a girl, not yet a woman, and not a serial killer. I ended up walking differently, carrying myself differently, talking differently. I was someone else for months while I filmed Crossroads. Still to this day, I bet the girls I shot that movie with think, she's a little quirky. If they thought that, they were right. I was a baby, just like the character. I should have played myself on camera. But I was so eager to do a good job that I kept trying to go deep with this character. I had been me my whole life, and I wanted to try something different. I should have just said to myself, it's a teen road movie. It's not that deep. Honestly, just have a good time. After the movie wrapped, one of my girlfriends from a club in L.A. came to visit me. We went to CVS. I swear to God, I walked into the store, and as I talked to her while we shopped, I finally came back to myself. When I came outside again, I was cured of the spell that movie had cast. It was so strange. My little spirit showed back up in my body. That trip to buy makeup with a friend was like waving some magic wand. Then I was pissed. I thought, oh my God, what have I been doing for the past few months? Who was I? That was pretty much the beginning and end of my acting career, and I was relieved. The Notebook casting came down to me and Rachel McAdams, and even though it would have been fun to reconnect with Ryan Gosling after our time on the Mickey Mouse Club, I'm glad I didn't do it. If I had, instead of working on my album, In the Zone, I'd have been acting like a 1940s heiress day and night. I'm sure a lot of the problem was that it was my first experience with acting. I imagine there are people in the acting field who have dealt with something like that, where they have had trouble separating themselves from a character. But I feel like they keep perspective. I hope I never get close to that occupational hazard again. Living that way, being half yourself and half a fictional character, is messed up. After a while, you don't know what's real anymore. Chapter 12. When I think back on that time, I was truly living the dream, living my dream. My tours took me all over the world. One of my happiest moments on tour was playing the music festival Rock in Rio 3 in January 2001. In Brazil, I felt liberated, like a child in some ways, a woman and a child, all in one. I was fearless at that point, filled with a rush and a drive. At night, my dancers, there were eight of them, two girls, the rest guys, and I went skinny dipping in the ocean, singing and dancing and laughing with each other. We talked for hours under the moon. It was so beautiful. Exhausted, we headed into the steam rooms where we talked some more. I was able to be a little bit sinful then. Skinny dipping, staying up talking all night, nothing over the top. It was a taste of rebellion and freedom, but I was just having fun and being a 19-year-old. The Dream Within a Dream tour, right after my album Brittany came out in the fall of 2001, was my fourth tour and one of my favorites. Every night on stage, I battled a mirror version of myself, which felt like it was probably a metaphor for something. But that mirror act was just one song. There was also flying, and an Egyptian barge, and a jungle, lasers, snow. Wade Robson directed and choreographed it, and I give great credit to the people who put it together. I thought it was well conceived. Wade had this concept of the show as reflecting a new, more mature phase in my life. The set and costumes were so clever. When someone knew just how to style me, I was always grateful. They were shrewd about how they presented me as a star, and I know I owe them. The way they captured me showed me they respected me as an artist. The minds behind that tour were brilliant. It was by far my best tour. It was what we all had hoped for. I had worked so hard to get to that point. I'd done mall tours before Baby was released. Then the Baby tour was the first time I got to see a lot of people out there in the crowd. I remember feeling like, oh wow, I'm somebody now. Then Oops was a little bit bigger, so by the time I did the Dream Within a Dream tour, it was all magic. By the spring of 2002, I had hosted SNL twice, playing a butter-churned girl at a colonial reenactment museum opposite Jimmy Fallon and Rachel Dratch, and then playing Barbie's little sister Skipper opposite Amy Poehler as Barbie. I was the youngest person to host and perform as the musical guest in the same episode. Around that time, I was asked if I'd like to be in a movie musical. I wasn't sure I wanted to act again after Crossroads, but I was tempted by this one. It was Chicago. Executives involved in the production came to a venue where I was performing and asked if I wanted to do it. I turned down 3 or 4 movies because I was in my moment with the stage show. I didn't want to be distracted from music. I was happy doing what I was doing. But I look back now and I think, when it came to Chicago, I should have done it. I had power back then. I wish I'd used it more thoughtfully, been more rebellious. Chicago would have been fun. It's all dance pieces, my favorite kind. Prissy, girly follies, pussycat doll-like serve-off-your-corset moves. I wish I'd taken that offer. I would have gotten to play a villain who kills a man and sings and dances while doing it, too. I probably could have found ways, gotten training to keep from becoming a Chicago character the way I had with Lucy in Crossroads. I wish I'd tried something different. If only I'd been brave enough not to stay in my safe zone, done more things that weren't just within what I knew. But I was committed to not rocking the boat and to not complaining even when something upset me. In my personal life, I was so happy. Justin and I lived together in Orlando. We shared a gorgeous, airy, 2-story house with a tile roof and a swimming pool out back. Even though we were both working a lot, we'd make time to be home together as often as we could. I always came back every few months so Justin and I could be together for 2 weeks, sometimes even 2 months at a time. That was our home base. 1 week when Jamie Lynn was young, my family flew out to see us. We all went to FAO Schwartz at Point Orlando. They closed down the whole store for us. My sister got a miniature convertible car that had actual doors that opened. It was in between a real car and a go-kart. Somehow we got it back to Kentwood and she drove it around the neighborhood until she outgrew it. That child in that car was unlike anything else, this adorable little girl driving around in a miniature red Mercedes. It was the cutest thing you could have ever seen in your entire life. I swear to God, the vision was unbelievable. That's how we all were with Jamie Lynn. You see it, you like it, you want it, you got it. As far as I could tell, her world was the Ariana Grande song, 7 Rings, come to life. When I was growing up, we didn't have any money. My prized possessions were my Madame Alexander dolls. There were dozens to choose from. Their eyelids went up and down, and they all had names. Some were fictional characters or historical figures like Scarlett O'Hara or Queen Elizabeth. I had the girls from Little Women. When I got my 15th doll, you would have thought I'd hit the lottery. That was a good time in my life. I was so in love with Justin, just smitten. I don't know if when you're younger, love's a different thing, but what Justin and I had was special. He wouldn't even have to say anything or do anything for me to feel close to him. In the South, moms love to round up the kids and say, "Listen, we're going to go to church today and we're all going to color coordinate." That's what I did when Justin and I attended the 2001 American Music Awards, which I co-hosted with LL Cool J. I still can't believe that Justin was going to wear denim, and I said, "We should match. Let's do denim on denim." At first, honestly, I thought it was a joke. I didn't think my stylist was actually going to do it, and I never thought Justin was going to do it with me, but they both went all in. The stylist brought Justin's all-denim outfit, which included a denim hat to match his denim jacket and denim pants. When he put it on, I thought, "Whoa, I guess we're really doing this." Justin and I were always going to events together. We had so much fun doing the Teen Choice Awards, and we often color-coordinated our outfits. But with the matching denim, we blew it up. That night, my corset had me sucked in so tight under my denim gown, I was about to fall over. I get that it was tacky, but it was also pretty great in its way, and I'm always happy to see it parodied as a Halloween costume. I've heard Justin get flack for the look. On a podcast where they were teasing him about it, he said, You do a lot of things when you're young and in love. And that's exactly right. We were giddy, and those outfits reflected that. There were a couple times during our relationship when I knew Justin had cheated on me. Especially because I was so infatuated and so in love, I let it go, even though the tabloids seemed determined to rub my face in it. When NSYNC went to London in 2000, photographers caught him with one of the girls from All Saints in a car, but I never said anything. At the time, we'd only been together for a year. Another time we were in Vegas, and one of my dancers who'd been hanging out with him told me he gestured toward a girl and said, "Yeah, man, I hit that last night." I don't want to say who he was talking about because she's actually very popular and she's married with kids now. I don't want her to feel bad. My friend was shocked and believed Justin was only saying it because he was high and felt like bragging. There were rumors about him with various dancers and groupies. I let it go. But clearly, he'd slept around. It was one of those things where you know, but you just don't say anything. So I did too, not a lot. One time, with Wade Robson. We were out one night and we went to a Spanish bar. We danced and danced. I made out with him that night. I was loyal to Justin for years, only had eyes for him with that one exception, which I admitted to him. That night was chalked up to something that will happen when you're as young as we were, and Justin and I moved past it and stayed together. I thought we were going to be together forever. I hoped we would be. At one point when we were dating, I became pregnant with Justin's baby. It was a surprise, but for me it wasn't a tragedy. I loved Justin so much. I always expected us to have a family together one day. This would just be much earlier than I'd anticipated. Besides, what was done was done. But Justin definitely wasn't happy about the pregnancy. He said we weren't ready to have a baby in our lives, that we were way too young. I could understand. I mean, I kind of understood. If he didn't want to become a father, I didn't feel like I had much of a choice. I wouldn't want to push him into something he didn't want. Our relationship was too important to me. And so I'm sure people will hate me for this. But I agreed not to have the baby. Abortion was something I never could have imagined choosing for myself. But given the circumstances, that is what we did. I don't know if that was the right decision. If it had been left up to me alone, I never would have done it. And yet Justin was so sure he didn't want to be a father. We also decided on something that in retrospect wound up being, in my view, wrong. And that was that I should not go to a doctor or to a hospital to have the abortion. It was important that no one find out about the pregnancy or the abortion, which meant doing everything at home. We didn't even tell my family. The only person who knew besides Justin and me was Felicia, who was always on hand to help me. I was told, "It might hurt a little bit, but you'll be fine." On the appointed day, with only Felicia and Justin there, I took the little pills. Soon I started having excruciating cramps. I went into the bathroom and stayed there for hours, lying on the floor, sobbing and screaming. It should have numbed me with something, I thought. I wanted some kind of anesthesia. I wanted to go to the doctor. I was so scared. I lay there wondering if I was going to die. When I tell you it was painful, I can't begin to describe it. The pain was unbelievable. I went down to the ground on my knees holding the toilet. For a long time, I couldn't move. To this day, it's one of the most agonizing things I have ever experienced in my life. Still, they didn't take me to the hospital. Justin came into the bathroom and lay on the floor with me. At some point, he thought maybe music would help, so he got his guitar and he lay there with me, strumming it. I kept crying and sobbing until it was all over. It took hours, and I don't remember how it ended, but I do, 20 years later, remember the pain of it and the fear. After that, I was messed up for a while, especially because I still did love Justin so much. It was insane how much I loved him, and for me, it was unfortunate. I should have seen the breakup coming, but I didn't. Chapter 13. When Justin began making his first solo album, Justified, he started being very standoffish with me. I think that was because he decided to use me as ammunition for his record, and so it made it awkward for him to be around me staring at him with all that affection and devotion. Ultimately, he ended our relationship by text message while I was on the set for the video of the Overprotected remix by Darkchild. After seeing the message as I sat in my trailer between takes, I had to go back out and dance. For as much as Justin hurt me, there was a huge foundation of love. And when he left me, I was devastated. When I say devastated, I mean I could barely speak for months. Whenever anyone asked me about him, all I could do was cry. I don't know if I was clinically in shock, but it felt that way. Everyone who knew me thought something was wrong with me, really wrong. I went back home to Kentwood and I couldn't talk to my family or friends. I barely left the house. I was that messed up. I lay in my bed and stared at the ceiling. Justin flew out to Louisiana to visit me. He brought me a long letter he'd written and framed. I still have it under my bed. And at the end it said, makes me want to cry to think about it, "I can't breathe without you." Those are the last words in it. Reading that, I thought, damn, he's a good writer. Because that was exactly how I felt. It almost felt like I was suffocating. Like I couldn't breathe after all that had happened. The thing is, though, even after I saw him and read the letter, I didn't come out of the trance. He did all that. He came there to see me, and I still couldn't talk to him or to anybody. Chapter 14. Even though the last thing I wanted to do was perform, I still had tour dates left in my contract, so I went back out to finish them. All I wanted was to get off the road, to have days and nights all to myself, to walk out onto the Santa Monica Pier and breathe in the salt air, listen to the rattle of the roller coaster, stare out at the ocean. Instead, every day was a grind, load in, load out, sound check, photo shoot, asking, what town are we even in? I'd loved the Dream Within a Dream tour when it started, but it had become a slog. I was tired in mind and body. I wanted to shut it all down. I'd begun fantasizing about opening a little shop in Venice Beach with Felicia and quitting show business completely. With the gift of hindsight, I can see that I hadn't given myself enough time to heal from the breakup with Justin. In late July 2002, at the very end of the tour, we headed south to do a show in Mexico City, but getting there was almost a disaster. We were traveling in vans, and once we'd crossed the border, we came to a sudden halt. We'd been stopped by a bunch of guys holding the biggest guns I'd ever seen. I was terrified. It felt like we were being ambushed. It just didn't make sense to me, but all I knew was we were surrounded by these angry-looking men. Everyone in my van was so tense. I had security with me, but who knew what was going to happen? After what felt like forever, there seemed to be some kind of peace talks happening. It was like in a movie. It's still a mystery to me what actually happened, but in the end, we were allowed to carry on, and we got to play to 50,000 people, though the second show, on the following day, had to be canceled halfway through because of a massive thunderstorm. That thunderstorm-canceled show was the last date of the Dream Within a Dream tour. But when I told people after finishing the tour that I wanted to rest, everyone seemed nervous. When you're successful at something, there's a lot of pressure to keep right on doing it, even if you're not enjoying it anymore. And as I would quickly find out, you really can't go home again. I did an interview with People magazine back in Louisiana for reasons that seemed ridiculous to me. I wasn't promoting anything. But my team thought I should show that I was doing well and just taking a little break. The photographer shot me outside and then inside with the dogs and my mom on the couch. They had me empty out my purse to reveal that I wasn't carrying drugs or cigarettes. All they found was juicy fruit gum, vanilla perfume, mints, and a little bottle of St. John's wort. "My daughter is doing beautifully," my mom told the reporter confidently. "She's never, ever been close to a breakdown." Part of what made that period of time so difficult is that Justin's family had been the only real, loving family I had. For holidays, the only family I would go to was his. I knew his grandmother and his grandfather, and I loved them so much. I thought of them as home. My mom would come out and visit us every once in a while, but she's not who I went home to. Ever. My mom was trying to recover from her divorce from my dad, which she'd finally gone through with. Depressed and self-medicating, she could barely get up off the couch. My dad was nowhere to be found. And my little sister. Well, when I tell you she was a total bitch, I'm not exaggerating. I had always been the worker bee. While I was doing my thing on the road with Felicia, I hadn't been paying attention to what was happening in Kentwood. But when I came home, I saw how things had changed. My mom would serve Jamie Lynn while she watched TV, bringing her little chocolate milkshakes. It was clear that girl ruled the roost. Meanwhile, it was like I was a ghost child. I can remember walking into the room and feeling like no one even saw me. Jamie Lynn only saw the TV. My mother, who at one time had been the person I was closest to in the world, was on another planet. And the way adolescent Jamie Lynn spoke to my mother, my mouth would just drop. I'd listen to her spew these hateful words, and I'd turn to my mother and say, "Are you going to let this little witch talk to you like that?" I mean, she was bad. I felt betrayed by how Jamie Lynn had changed. I'd bought a house for Jamie Lynn to grow up in. She was not exactly grateful for it. She'd later say, "Why'd she get us a house?" Like it was some sort of imposition. But that house had been a gift. I'd bought it because our family had needed a new house, and I wanted her to have a better life than I had. Life in Louisiana had passed me by. I felt like I had no one to talk to. Going through that breakup, going home, and seeing how much I didn't fit in anywhere anymore, I realized that I was technically growing up, becoming a woman. And yet, honestly, it was almost like I went backward at the same time and became younger in my mind. Have you seen The Curious Case of Benjamin Button? That's how I felt. Somehow, that year, in becoming more vulnerable, I started to feel like a child again. Chapter 15. To get my confidence back, in September 2002, I went to Milan to visit Donatella Versace. That trip invigorated me. It reminded me that there was still fun to be had in the world. We drank amazing wine and ate amazing food. Donatella was a dynamic host. I was hoping things would turn around a little bit from that point. She had invited me to Italy to attend one of her runway shows. Donatella dressed me in a beautiful, sparkly rainbow dress. I was supposed to sing, but I really didn't feel like it. So after I did a little bit of posing, Donatella said we could take it easy. She played my cover of Joan Jett's I Love Rock and Roll. I said hi to the models, and we were done. Then it was time to party. Donatella is known for her lavish parties, and this one was no exception. I remember seeing Lenny Kravitz there, all these cool people. That party was really the first thing I did to put myself out there a bit after the breakup with Justin. On my own, innocent. During the party, I noticed a guy, and I remember thinking he was so cute. He looked like he was probably Brazilian, dark hair, handsome, smoking a blunt. Your typical bad boy. He was nothing like the LA actor types I'd known. He was more like a real man. The kind of man you have a one-night stand with. He was just sex. When I first noticed him, he was off talking to these two girls, but I could tell he wanted to talk to me. Eventually, we started talking, and I decided I'd like to have drinks with him at my hotel. We headed to my car, but during the drive, he did something that just turned me off, honestly. I can't even remember what it was, but it was one little thing that really irritated me, so I told the driver to pull over and without saying a word, I kicked the guy out on the side of the road and left him there. Now that I'm a mom, I'd never do anything like that. I'd be more like, I'll drop you off at this place at this time. But back then, at 20 years of age, it was pure instinct. I'd made a bad mistake letting this stranger inside my car, and I kicked him out. Soon after my return, Justin was preparing to release his solo album, Justified. On 2020, he played an unreleased song for Barbara Walters called Don't Go, Horrible Woman, that seemed to be about me. I thought our love was so strong. I guess I was dead wrong. But to look at it positively, hey girl, at least you gave me a song about another horrible woman. Less than a month later, he released the video for his song Cry Me a River, in which a woman who looks like me cheats on him and he wanders around sad in the rain. In the news media, I was described as a harlot who'd broken the heart of America's golden boy. The truth? I was comatose in Louisiana and he was happily running around Hollywood. May I just say, on his explosive album and in all the press that surrounded it, Justin neglected to mention the several times he cheated on me. There's always been more leeway in Hollywood for men than for women. And I see how men are encouraged to talk trash about women in order to become famous and powerful. But I was shattered. The thought of my betraying him gave the album more angst, gave it a purpose. Shit-talking an unfaithful woman. The hip-hop world of that era loved a storyline with the theme, "Fuck you, bitch." Getting revenge on women for perceived disrespect was all the rage at the time. Eminem's violent revenge song, Kim, was huge. The only problem with the narrative was that, in our case, it wasn't like that. Cry Me a River did very well. Everyone felt very sorry for him. And it shamed me. I felt there was no way at the time to tell my side of the story. I couldn't explain. Because I knew no one would take my side once Justin had convinced the world of his version. I don't think Justin realized the power he had in shaming me. I don't think he understands to this day. After Cry Me a River came out, anywhere I went, I could get booed. I would go to clubs and I would hear boos. Once I went to a Lakers game with my little sister and one of my brother's friends, and the whole place, the whole arena, booed me. Justin told everyone that he and I had had a sexual relationship, which some people have pointed out depicted me as not only a cheating slut, but also a liar and hypocrite. Given that I had so many teenage fans, my managers and press people had long tried to portray me as an eternal virgin. Never mind that Justin and I had been living together and I'd been having sex since I was 14. Was I mad at being outed by him as sexually active? No. To be honest with you, I liked that Justin said that. Why did my managers work so hard to claim I was some kind of young girl virgin, even into my 20s? Whose business was it if I'd had sex or not? I'd appreciated it when Oprah told me on her show that my sexuality was no one else's business, and that when it came to virginity, you don't need a world announcement if you change your mind. Yes, as a teenager, I played into that portrayal because everyone was making such a big deal out of it. But if you think about it, it was pretty stupid for people to describe my body in that way, for them to point at me and say, look, a virgin. It's nobody's business at all. And it took the focus off me as a musician and a performer. I worked so hard on my music and on my stage shows. But all some reporters could think of to ask me was whether or not my breasts were real. They were, actually. And whether or not my hymen was intact. The way Justin admitted to everyone that we'd had a sexual relationship broke the ice and made it so that I never had to come out myself as a non-virgin. His talking about our having had sex never bothered me at all. And I've defended him to people who criticized him for doing it. That's so rude, people have said about his talking about me sexually. But I liked it. What I heard when he said that was, she's a woman. No, she's not a virgin. Shut up. As a child, I'd always had a guilty conscience, a lot of shame, a sense that my family thought I was just plain bad. The sadness and the loneliness that would hit me felt like my fault somehow, like I deserved unhappiness and bad luck. I knew that the truth of our relationship was nothing like how it was being portrayed, but I still imagined that if I was suffering, I must have deserved it. Along the line, surely I'd done bad things. I believe in karma, and so when bad things happen, I imagine that it's just the law of karma catching up with me. I've always been almost disturbingly empathic. What people are feeling in Nebraska, I can subconsciously feel, even though I'm thousands of miles away. Sometimes women's periods sync up. I feel like my emotions are always syncing up with those around me. I don't know what hippie word you want to use for it, cosmic consciousness, intuition, psychic connection. All I know is that 100% I can feel the energy of other people. I can't help but take it in. At this point, you might be saying to yourself, oh my God, is she really going to talk about this new age stuff? Only for one more minute. Because the point is, I was so sensitive, and I was so young, and I was still reeling from the abortion and the breakup. I didn't handle things well. Justin framed our time together with me as the bad guy, and I believed it. So ever since then, I've felt like I'm under a sort of curse. And yet, I also started to hope that if it were true, if I had so much bad karma, it might be up to me, as an adult, as a woman, to reverse my luck, to bring myself good fortune. I couldn't stand it anymore, so I escaped to Arizona with a girlfriend. That girlfriend happened to have been dating Justin's best friend, and we'd all broken up around the same time, so we decided to take a road trip to get away from all of it. We found each other and decided we would leave it all behind. Given what she'd been through, my friend was heartbroken too, so we talked a lot, beside ourselves with grief and loneliness, and I was grateful for her friendship. The sky overhead was full of stars while we drove fast through the desert, in a convertible with the top down, the wind blowing in our hair, no music playing, just the sound of the night whipping past us. As we looked out at the road stretched before us, an eerie feeling settled over me. I'd been moving so fast for so long, it was like I couldn't even catch my breath. Now, in this moment, something filled me. A profound beauty, otherworldly and humbling. I looked over at my friend, wondering if I should say something, but what could I say? Do you believe in aliens? So I stayed quiet and sat there with the feeling for a long moment. Then I heard her voice over the wind. Do you feel that? She said. She looked at me. What is that? Whatever it was, she felt it too. I reached for her hand and held it tight. The poet Rumi says the wound is the place where the light enters you. I've always believed that. The thing we felt that night in Arizona, we felt it at that moment because we needed it. We were so spiritually open and so raw. It showed us that there was more than just what we could see. Call it God, call it a higher power, or call it a paranormal experience. Whatever it was real enough that we could experience it together. While it was first happening, I didn't want to bring it up to my friend because I was embarrassed. I was scared she would think that I'd lost my mind. There have been so many times when I was scared to speak up because I was afraid somebody would think I was crazy. But I've learned that lesson now the hard way. You have to speak the thing that you're feeling, even if it scares you. You have to tell your story. You have to raise your voice. There was a lot I still had left to discover that night when I was lost and felt God in the desert. But I knew that I wouldn't let the darkness consume me. Even in the darkest night, you can still find so much light. Chapter 16. Justin ended up sleeping with 6 or 7 girls in the weeks after we officially broke up, or so I heard. Hey, I get it. He was Justin Timberlake. This was his first time to go solo. He was a girl's dream. I was in love with him. I understood the infatuation people had with him. I decided if Justin was going to date, I should try to get out there too. I hadn't dated in a while, since I'd been heartbroken and on tour. That winter, I saw a guy who I thought was handsome, and a club promoter friend said I had good taste. That guy is so cool, my friend said, His name is Colin Farrell, and he's shooting a movie right now. Well, talk about balls. I got in my car, and I drove up to the set of his action movie, SWAT. Who did I think I was? There was no security or anything, so I went straight onto the soundstage where they were doing a set piece in a house. When the director saw me, he said, "Come sit in my chair." "Okay," I said. So I sat in the chair and watched them shoot. Colin came over and said, "Do you have any pointers for what I should do here?" He was inviting me to direct him. We wound up having a 2-week brawl. Brawl is the only word for it. We were all over each other, grappling so passionately it was like we were in a street fight. In the course of our fun time together, he took me to the premiere of a spy thriller he was in called The Recruit with Al Pacino. I was so flattered he asked me to go. I wore a pajama top. I thought it was a real shirt because it had miniature studs on it, but I see the photos and I think, yeah, I definitely wore a full-blown pajama top to Colin Farrell's premiere. I was so excited to be at the premiere. Colin's whole family was there and they were so warm to me. As I had before, when I'd felt too attached to a man, I tried to convince myself in every way that it was not a big deal, that we were just having fun, that in this case I was vulnerable because I wasn't over Justin yet. But for a brief moment in time, I did think there could be something there. The disappointments in my romantic life were just one part of how isolated I became. I felt so awkward all the time. I did try to be social. Natalie Portman, who I'd known since we were little girls in the New York theater circuit, and I even hosted a New Year's Eve party together. But it took a huge amount of effort. Most days I couldn't even bring myself to call a friend on the phone. The thought of going out and being brave on stage or at clubs, even at parties or dinners, filled me with fear. Joy around groups of other people was rare. Most of the time I had serious social anxiety. The way social anxiety works is that what feels like a totally normal conversation to most people, to you, feels mortifying. Being around people at all, especially at a party or some other situation with expectations of presenting well, for no apparent reason, causes surges of embarrassment. I was afraid of being judged or of saying something stupid. When that feeling hits, I want to be alone. I get scared and I just want to excuse myself to the bathroom and then sneak out. I veered between being very social and being incredibly isolated. I kept hearing that I seemed so confident. It was hard for anyone to imagine that someone who could perform for thousands at a time could, backstage, with just one or two people, be gripped by panic. Anxiety is strange that way. And mine grew as it became clear to me that whatever I did, and even plenty I didn't do, became front page news. These stories were often illustrated by unflattering photos of me taken when I least expected it. I was already designed to care what others thought about me. The national spotlight turned my natural tendency to worry into something unbearable. While the news about me was often not all that friendly, the entertainment press was full of positive stories about Justin and Christina Aguilera. Justin was on the cover of Rolling Stone, half naked. Christina was on the cover of Blender, dressed like a madam from the Old West. They were together on the cover of Rolling Stone, him in a black tank top, looking at her with sexy eyes, her looking out at the camera, wearing a lace-up black shirt. In that story, she said she thought Justin and I should get back together, which was just confusing, given how negative she'd been elsewhere. Seeing people I'd known so intimately talk about me that way in the press stung. Even if they weren't trying to be cruel, it felt like they were just pouring salt in the wound. Why was it so easy for everyone to forget that I was a human being, vulnerable enough that these headlines could leave a bruise? Wanting to disappear, I found myself living in New York City alone for months, in a 4-story NoHo apartment that Cher used to live in. It had tall ceilings, a terrace with a view of the Empire State Building, and a working fireplace much fancier than the one that had been in the living room of our house in Kentwood. It would have been a dream apartment to use as a home base to explore the city, but I hardly ever left the place. One of the only times I did, a man behind me on an elevator said something that made me laugh. I turned around, and it was Robin Williams. At one point, I realized I had somehow lost the key to the apartment. I was arguably the biggest star on Earth, and I didn't even have a key to my own apartment. What a fucking idiot. I was stuck, both emotionally and physically. Without a key, I couldn't go anywhere. I also wasn't willing to communicate with anyone. I had nothing to say. But trust that I always have the key to my house these days. I didn't go to the gym. I didn't go out to eat. I only talked with my security guard and Felicia, who, now that I no longer needed a chaperone, had become my assistant and was still my friend. I fell off the face of the earth. I ate takeout for every meal. And this will probably sound strange, but I was content staying home. I liked it there. I felt safe. On rare occasions, I went out. One night, I put on a $129 BB dress and high heels, and my cousin took me to a sexy underground club with low ceilings and red walls. I took a couple hits from a joint my first time smoking pot. Later, I walked all the way home so I could take in the city, breaking one of my heels along the way. When I got to my apartment, I went to my terrace and just looked up at the stars for hours. At that moment, I felt one with New York. One of my few visitors during that strange, surreal time was Madonna. She walked into the place and immediately, of course, she owned the room. I remember thinking, it's Madonna's room now. Stunningly beautiful, she exuded power and confidence. She walked straight to the window, looked out, and said, "Nice view." "Yeah, it's a nice view, I guess," I said. Madonna's supreme confidence helped me see a lot about my situation with fresh eyes. I think she probably had some intuitive sense of what I was going through. I needed a little guidance at that time. I was confused about my life. She tried to mentor me. At one point, she did a red string ceremony with me to initiate me into Kabbalah. And she gave me a trunk full of Zohar books to pray with. At the base of my neck, I tattooed a word in Hebrew that means one of the 72 names of God. Some Kabbalists think of it as meaning healing, which was the thing I was still trying to do. In many ways, Madonna did have a good effect on me. She told me I should be sure to take time out for my soul, and I tried to do that. She modeled a type of strength that I needed to see. There were so many different ways to be a woman in the industry. You could get a reputation for being a diva. You could be professional, or you could be nice. I had always tried so hard to please my parents, to please audiences, to please everyone. I must have learned that helplessness from my mom. I saw the way my sister and my dad treated her and how she just took it. Early in my career, I followed that model and became passive. I wish I'd had more of a mentor then to be a badass bitch for me so I could have learned how to do that sooner. If I could go back now, I would try to become my own parent, my own partner, my own advocate, the way I knew Madonna did. She had endured so much sexism and bullying from the public and the industry and had been shamed for her sexuality so many times, but she always overcame it. When Madonna accepted her Billboard Woman of the Year award a few years ago, she said she'd been subjected to blatant misogyny, sexism, constant bullying, and relentless abuse. If you're a girl, you have to play the game. What is that game? You're allowed to be pretty and cute and sexy, but don't act too smart, don't have an opinion. She's right that the music industry, really the whole world, is set up more for men. Especially if you're nice, like me, you can be completely destroyed. By that point, I'd become almost too nice. Everywhere I went, Felicia would write thank you notes to the chef, the bartender, the secretary. To this day, as a Southern girl, I believe in a handwritten thank you note. Madonna saw how much I wanted to please, and how I wanted to do what others did instead of locking something down and saying, "Okay, everyone, listen up. This is what's going to happen." We decided to perform together at the VMAs. Every time we rehearsed it, we did an air kiss. About 2 minutes before the performance, I was sitting on the side of the stage and thinking about my biggest performance to date at the VMAs when I'd pulled off a suit to reveal a sparkly outfit. I thought to myself, I want a moment like that again this year, with the kiss. Should I just go for it? A lot was made of that kiss. Oprah asked Madonna about it. The kiss was treated as a huge cultural moment, Britney kissing Madonna, and it got us both a lot of attention. While we were rehearsing for the VMAs, I'd also had an idea for a collaboration. In the Culver City studio, my team and I were sitting on silver metal folding chairs talking about how the record company was lukewarm on my new song, Me Against the Music, a song I loved. I'd just done I'm a Slave for You on my last record, and Barry Weiss, who ran my label, wanted more songs like that. But I was pushing for Me Against the Music hard. Then what if we do a feature on it, I said. A song can become a massive hit because of the event that drives it. I thought if we could find someone to be on the song, we could create a story around it. Who do you want to feature? My manager asked. Her, I said, pointing across the room at Madonna. Let's get her on the song. Holy shit, he said. Yeah, that'd work. Instead of asking through her team, we agreed that I would ask her directly. So I went over to Madonna. Let's talk, I said. I told her how much fun it would be to do the song with me and how I thought we could help each other. It was something that would benefit us both. She agreed. Me Against the Music is still one of my favorite songs, and the collaboration with her is part of what makes it so memorable. On the first day of our shoot for the song's video, which was to last 2 or 3 days, we were told a seam had come undone on Madonna's white suit, and a seamstress had to be called to fix it so there would be a delay in our start time. I wound up having to sit in my trailer for hours waiting for the suit to be fixed. Really, I thought? I didn't even know taking so much time for oneself was an option. If I broke a heel on my shoe, I would never make production take the 5 minutes to let me fix it. I would do whatever the director told me to do, even if I had to hobble onto the set without a heel, even if I had to show up barefoot. During our shoot together, I was in awe of the ways Madonna would not compromise her vision. She kept the focus on her. Going along with Madonna's ideas and being on her time for days was what it meant to collaborate with her. It was an important lesson for me, one that would take a long time for me to absorb. She demanded power, and so she got power. She was the center of attention because she made that the condition of her showing up anywhere. She made that life for herself. I hoped I could find ways to do that while preserving the parts of my nice girl identity that I wanted to keep. Chapter 17. I was happy with my new album, In the Zone. Me Against the Music featuring Madonna was the first single off the album. The next single was Toxic, for which I won a Grammy Award. Toxic was innovative as well as a massive success and is still one of my favorites to perform. To promote the album, I went out with an MTV camera crew in New York City one night to film a special called In the Zone and Out All Night. We drove all over the city to appear at 3 nightclubs, Show, Splash, and Avalon. It was electrifying to see large groups of people dancing to the new songs. As has happened again and again in my career, my fans reminded me why I do what I do. But then, one day, there was a knock on my door. When I opened it, 4 men just walked in right past me. I didn't recognize 3 of them. I'd never seen their faces before in my life. The 4th was my father. They proceeded to sit me down on a sofa, the same one I have to this day in my bedroom. Immediately, they started peppering me with questions, questions, and more questions. I was mute. I wasn't willing to talk with anyone. I had nothing to say. A day later, I got a call from my team that I was going to speak to Diane Sawyer, and on that same sofa. Because of what had happened with Justin and everything I'd been through, I felt like I was no longer able to communicate with the world. I had a dark cloud over my head. I was traumatized. I'd often retreated to my apartment to be alone. Now I was being forced to speak to Diane Sawyer there and cry in front of the entire nation. It was completely humiliating. I wasn't told what the questions would be ahead of time, and it turned out they were 100% embarrassing. I was too vulnerable then, too sensitive to do this type of interview. She asked things like, he's going on television and saying you broke his heart. You did something that caused him so much pain, so much suffering. What did you do? I didn't want to share anything private with the world. I didn't owe the media details of my breakup. I shouldn't have been forced to speak on national TV, forced to cry in front of this stranger, a woman who was relentlessly going after me with harsh question after harsh question. Instead, I felt like I had been exploited, set up in front of the whole world. That interview was a breaking point for me internally. A switch had been flipped. I felt something dark come over my body. I felt myself turning, almost like a werewolf, into a bad person. I honestly feel like that moment in my life should have been a time for growing and not sharing everything with the world. It would have been the better way to heal. But I had no choice. It seemed like nobody really cared how I felt. Back home in Louisiana again for the holidays, I invited some friends over. We were trying to hang out in the guest house I'd built behind the main house, and my mother got annoyed with us for being noisy. Suddenly it hit me that I had enough money that we did not have to stay in Louisiana. I booked us a trip to Las Vegas for New Year's Eve, and some friends from my tour joined us. We cut loose at the Palms Casino Resort and drank. A lot. I'll admit that we got phenomenally stupid. I will also say that this was the one time when I almost felt overwhelmed having that much freedom in Sin City. I was this little girl who had worked so much, and then all of a sudden the schedule was blank for a few days, and so, hello, alcohol. Paris Hilton showed up at the casino to hang out and have some drinks. Before I knew it, we got on top of tables, took our shoes off, and ran through the whole club like fairy-dusted idiots. No one got hurt, and I had the best time with Paris. We were just playing, and we still do every time we get together. I wasn't rude to anybody. It was just innocent fun. Most people will probably judge, and now you can't do things like that because people will all whip their cameras out. But back then, that time in Vegas, we just acted silly. Having already been under so much media scrutiny, I wasn't interested in causing trouble. It was about feeling free and enjoying what I'd been working so hard to achieve. As a 20-something will do after a few drinks, I wound up in bed with one of my old friends, a childhood friend who I'd known forever. The third night we were there together, he and I got shit-faced. I don't even remember that night at all, but from what I've pieced together, he and I lounged around the hotel room, stayed up late watching movies, Mona Lisa Smile and the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, then had the brilliant idea of going to a little white chapel at 3:30 in the morning. When we got there, another couple was getting married, so we had to wait. Yes, we waited in line to get married. People have asked me if I loved him. To be clear, he and I were not in love. I was just honestly very drunk. And probably in a more general sense at that time in my life, very bored. The next day, my whole family flew out to Vegas. They showed up and stared at me with these eyes of such fury. I looked around. What happened last night? I asked. Did I kill someone? You got married, they said, as if that might be somehow worse. We were just having fun, I said. But my mom and dad took it so seriously. We have to get this annulled, they said. They made way too big of a deal out of innocent fun. Everybody has a different perspective on it, but I didn't take it that seriously. I thought a goof-around Vegas wedding was something people might do as a joke. Then my family came and acted like I'd started World War III. I cried the whole rest of the time I was in Las Vegas. I'm guilty, I said. I'm so sorry. I shouldn't have gotten married. We signed all the documents they told us to sign. The marriage lasted 55 hours. I thought it was strange that they got so involved so quickly and so decisively, without my even having time to quite regret what I'd done. It wasn't that I wanted to start a family with this guy or to be with him forever. It was nothing like that. And yet what happened was that my parents interrogated me so much about it that part of me almost said, hey, maybe I do want to be married. Every young person knows what it feels like to want to rebel against your family, especially if they're controlling. I now feel like I was having a very human reaction. They were putting a curious amount of pressure on me about something I thought was innocuous, and in any case, that was my own business. In fact, my family was so against the wedding that I started to think maybe I'd accidentally committed a brilliant act. Because I realized Something about my being under their control and not having a stronger connection to someone else had become very, very important to them. What do I have over you guys? I wondered. Why would someone else be so huge a threat? Perhaps it's worth mentioning that, by this point, I was supporting them financially. Everyone was asking me, where do you go from here? And it was a good question. I had the answer. I told interviewers again and again that what I most wanted was some time to myself. I'd started to dream about finding true love and settling down. I felt like I'd been missing out on life. Chapter 18. We hit the road once again. More buses, more costume racks, more long rehearsals, more step and repeats. That was already one of the darkest times of my life, and the vibe of the tour was dark too. A lot of sweaty numbers, dark themes, and moody lighting. The tour also marked a change in my relationship with my brother, Brian. Working now as part of my team, Brian was very well paid, and so was I, for the Onyx Hotel tour. He also did a huge deal for me with Elizabeth Arden. And yet, I had trouble not resenting him a bit once I went out on what was to be an unbelievably grueling tour while he stayed in Los Angeles and New York and enjoyed his life. I lost track of my brother in those years. And so, in many ways, it felt as though I lost Justin and Brian.